Why have we got a CAP ministry in this church? In fact, how has the CAP ministry got anything remotely to do with church? Because the CAP ministry is about, particularly this morning, we're thinking about the debt ministry. That ministry is about dealing with banks and dealing with financial institutions and dealing with the courts. What's that got to do with the life of the church? Should we be doing this at all? Isn't it true that some of the people that CAP works with got into their circumstances through no fault of their own? You've heard the story that Kathy shared this morning, how unemployment can change everything. But there are also people with whom the CAP ministry is involved who got themselves into the position that they're in. So what has the church got to do interfering in the financial affairs of people who got themselves where they are? I kind of hear this static sometimes in the background of the life of our church. So is CAP something that we should be doing at all? Well, in Luke chapter 4, in those verses we just read, Jesus says something really important that underlines just how strategic and godly the CAP ministry actually is. Because in those verses we just read a moment or two ago, Jesus talks about his ministry, and he describes that ministry by quoting some verses from the Old Testament, verses that originally came from the pen of the prophet Isaiah. Jesus says, "What am I here to do? The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What is Jesus talking about? What does this quotation from Isaiah actually mean? Jesus is referring to an Old Testament institution called Jubilee. In the Old Testament, as you'll be familiar, the Old Testament had a basic idea of Sabbath. It was instituted from the beginning when God made the world, and he rested on the seventh day. And he then instituted the Sabbath as a practice for all of mankind, not just for the Jews. This was a creation ordinance long before the law was ever given at Sinai. God rested on the seventh day, and he hallowed the seventh day, and he called all of humanity to live in this rhythm of work and rest. And that Sabbath that God talks about in the Old Testament was for people, was for the Israelites, but it wasn't just for them. It was also for strangers and foreigners who came to live in Israel. It was also for the servants of people who were wealthy enough to have servants. And it was also for animals. Even the animals got to get a break on the seventh day. And that idea of Sabbath is all through the Old Testament. However, God also planned that not only the people of Israel and the strangers and foreigners who lived in the land and the servants of the wealthy and the animals on the farms, not only would all those people have a Sabbath rest one day a week, one day in seven, but he also decided that the land needed a Sabbath. And so he instituted that idea that one year in seven, the land would get a break. In Leviticus chapter 25, it's too long for me to read it this morning. You can read it later. But in Leviticus chapter 25, God says, you can't farm your land on the seventh year. Now, anybody who's a farmer, and there's not too many of you here, but anybody who's a farmer and anybody else with an ounce of common sense will say to themselves, but if you don't plant any crops in the seventh year, what are you going to eat? Well, God said, if you observe this idea that I have given to you, this rule that I'm telling you to obey, give the land a rest one year in seven, then the sixth year will be incredible. Every sixth year will be big enough to feed you through the sixth year and the seventh year into the eighth year until you get your next crop. And so the land had a Sabbath one year in seven. But God said that still wasn't enough. So the people of Israel got a rest, the foreigners and strangers got a rest, the servants of the wealthy got a rest, the animals got a rest, and the land got a rest. But he said, there's one other thing I need to do. And he instituted a super Sabbath after seven sevens. So you had 7 years on the first Sabbath, and then another 7 years, and then another 7 years. So 49 years give you seven Sabbaths, and the 50th year was the Jubilee. And the Jubilee was a rest for what? For debt The Jubilee was a rest for those in debt. And God instituted it as part of the life of Israel. Israel was to have a unique set of economic arrangements, which was based on two simple principles. Here was the first one. In Israel, God said, nobody can own land or people. Nobody can buy land or people. Why? Because he says in Leviticus 25:23, the land and the people belong to me. They are mine, not yours. So you cannot buy them in perpetuity. You cannot buy a piece of land and keep it forever. You can't do that because it doesn't belong to you. It's not yours to sell. And it's not yours to buy. It belongs to me. And you cannot buy people in perpetuity either. They may serve for a period of time, but you cannot buy them because they are not theirs to sell, and they are not yours to buy because they belong to me. That was the first principle. The land and the people belong to God. And the second principle was this, that when they entered the land of Canaan, the children of Israel, every member, every family, and every tribe was given a piece of land as theirs. It didn't belong to them in the sense that they could sell it permanently, but it was given to them to be their inheritance. And everyone in the nation received a piece of land, unless you were a Levite, when you didn't, and other arrangements were made for your upkeep. But if you were an ordinary Israelite, you received a piece of ground. And those were the two basic principles on which this Israelite economic situation was based. And that ground given by God to your family was your family's for good. Didn't belong to them, but it was theirs to use for good. You couldn't part company with it. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't give it away. It belonged to your family. God gave it to you. Now, you know what happened next. Dead easy to predict, okay? Because if I picked any 10 people out of church this morning and gave you £100, after a week would be over, some of those people would have made £1,000 with it. Other people wouldn't have a penny left. That's the way we are. We're all different. And God gives the piece of ground to all the Israelites. Some of them were very industrious. Some of them were really good farmers. Some of them were shrewd, more than their brothers and sisters were. And so through time, what happened? Some people's pieces of ground wasn't worked properly. They got into difficulties. Or in other ways, they got into problems. Perhaps a husband got injured working in the fields and could no longer work and couldn't bring a harvest from his ground. What happened over a period of time was this. Gradually, some people did well, some people did badly, some people did so badly that the only way they could support themselves was to sell their farm to their neighbors and live off the money they got. And then sometimes it got so really bad that not only did they have to sell the farm, but they had to sell themselves into servanthood. And this happened, and it happened over a period of time. So how was the land to be valued? Or how was the person to be valued if they were going to sell that piece of ground? The answer was, the value was estimated at how long was remaining between now, when you wanted to sell a piece of ground, and the next Jubilee. Let's say it was 17 years away when you needed to sell your ground. Your ground wasn't valued by some absolute figure. It wasn't valued by what you could get of it in the marketplace. It was valued by the fact that there were 17 harvests left, and it was bought at that value. And if you sold yourself because you couldn't cope and you sold yourself to be someone else's servant, you couldn't be their slave, God had banned that, but you could be their servant. And if you sold yourself into service to that other person, the price of your life was the price of a working man's wage for the next 17 years. That was the price. So God instituted this idea. Okay, so the value of a land or the value of a person in terms of the marketplace had to do with how many years are left until the Jubilee. And if there were lots of years left, the land was more valuable. If there were only a few years left, the land was worth less. Why is this important? Because two words come into play at this point in the Old Testament. First one was the idea of redemption. Suppose you got into trouble, you sold your farm to your neighbor, but then a member of your family came along and said, I can help you to get your farm back. What was the price to get your farm back? Was it the price that your neighbor paid for it when you sold it to him? No. Was it the fact that land had gone up in value, so you actually had to pay, you had to pay more to get your land back than you got for it in the first place? No. The value of your land, the price you would pay to get your land back, was the number of years left until the next Jubilee. So the person who bought your land would get back for it less than he paid. You sold yourself into servanthood and a relative came and said, I'll help you out. Or maybe you did a bit better and you saved up enough money. You wanted to buy yourself out of service. What was your price to buy yourself free? The number of years till the next Jubilee. The person who paid for your service got less back than he paid out for it in the first place. God built in automatic depreciation. It was like a leasing agreement. This was incredibly different from all the other arrangements made in the rest of the world, that the redemption price for the land or for the individual would always be less than the person paid for that piece of ground or that person's service in the first place. So the first great idea was the idea of redemption, and God fixed a price. He put a limit on it and said, you're not really buying land, you're buying the ability to harvest. And if there's only 17 harvests left, that's the price you pay. And you're not buying that person. They are not yours to buy and to enslave. They belong to me. You are buying their service. So their service is worth a working man's wage for whatever number of years are left until the Jubilee. It was an incredible system. And you see it coming about in the Bible narrative sometimes. Like, for example, in the book of Ruth, when Boaz steps forward and buys Naomi's farm, what's he doing? He's paying the price, whatever that land is worth between now and the next Jubilee. Redemption. You can redeem this. God puts a limited price on the land and the people. The second word that comes in is release. Release. Say no relative step forward to help you out. Your land remains the property of the farmer next door. Say no relative steps forward to buy you out of your servanthood. And you remain that person's servant for the next number of years up to the Jubilee. What happens when the Jubilee comes? When the Jubilee comes, your land's value is zero. The Jubilee has arrived. There are no more harvests. When the Jubilee comes, your value is zero. The Jubilee has come. There are no more years of service. The land is free, and you are free. You are released after the 50 years is over. You no longer belong to someone else. Your ground no longer belongs to someone else. It is yours and your family's again. God allows for redemption and God allows for release. This is Godonomics, we might call it. This is what God wanted to be the situation in his people Israel in the Old Testament. It may never have actually happened. It may never have actually happened, but that was God's plan. That was what God wanted to take place. Why am I bothering to take all this time to explain to you the Jubilee? And what has it got to do with the ministry of CAP? Two things. First thing is this. God cares about economics. Why else would he have instituted this set of arrangements in Israel if it didn't matter to him? If God wanted to have a society in which there would be fairness and equality for all, and in which injustice would be carefully dealt with, so that fixed prices would be set down for land and for people's service, and that no one could profit from that, and no one could accumulate large amounts of land to become fabulously wealthy while everybody else became poor, God specifically stopped that happening through the arrangements for the Jubilee, because every 50 years, everything went back to the people who originally owned it, no matter what you did in the meantime. God cares about economics. He cares about the poor. Justin Welby spoke up yesterday about the ongoing row over fuel prices in the United Kingdom. He's the Archbishop of Canterbury. Why is he talking about fuel prices? What business is it of the Archbishop of Canterbury what the price of gas is? It matters to Justin Welby because it matters to God. If people in this country who are poor can't heat their homes and look after their families properly, God is concerned about that. And if the economic system that we have in this country through these huge hikes in gas and other prices is simply a huge hike in price, not to install more facilities so that the gas supply is better, but just to have more profits for the shareholders and the people who own the companies. And if those profits are being made at the expense of people not being able to heat their homes and look after their children, that's wrong. That's wrong. And God is concerned about that, and Justin Welby is right to speak about it. Economics matter to God. And therefore, cap is a godly thing to do, to seek to limit the consequences of debt and to release people from its burdens is a godly thing to do, even if those people are to blame for the circumstances in which they find themselves. Because that's what the Jubilee was all about. The Jubilee, it didn't matter how you ended up losing your fields. It didn't matter how you had ended up losing your freedom. Whether it was your fault or whether it was a result of circumstances over which you had no control, it didn't matter. The Jubilee set you free. The same redemption price applied whether you had been stupid and foolish with your resources or whether you had been wise and plunged into debt because some terrible tragedy happened to your family. The redemption price was the same. We learn from the Jubilee that God cares about economics. He cares about systems in the world that enslave and oppress and are unjust on other people, ordinary people, especially poor people. God cares about that. We should care about that. And CAP is a great ministry. It is a godly thing to do. But secondly, something else. Something else. Because Jesus says that day in the synagogue, when he quotes these verses from Isaiah, he says, "This is what I'm here to do. The Spirit of the Lord is on me so I can announce good news to the poor and proclaim the day of the Lord's favor," the Jubilee. And then it says he closes the scroll and he hands it back to the attendant and he sits down, because in Jewish practice, people stood up to read the scripture and sat down to teach, which I couldn't do because then I couldn't walk across the front of this church backwards and forwards all the time, which might be less annoying for you, but I just couldn't do that. So Jesus sat down, and when he sat down, he said these amazing words, "Today, the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." He said, "Today, the Jubilee has come." What on earth was he talking about? All of a sudden, was a brand new set of economic arrangements going to take place under Roman rule in Israel? No, I don't think so. So what did he mean when he said, "Today, this has been fulfilled in your hearing"? Jesus was talking about the scandal of the gospel. See, God's economics are scandalous. Because people pay money for things, they never get that money back. That's a scandal, isn't it? If you pay for someone, you expect to get your money back. God said, "I guarantee you up front right now, you won't get your money back." It's a scandal. But so is the gospel. So is the gospel. The gospel is a scandal. Why is the gospel a scandal? Because in the gospel, God shows that he is consistent. He doesn't just say to the people in Israel that we have to try to restrict and limit the consequences of debt. We're going to do that by instituting the Jubilee and by having a fixed price for land and for people. We're going to limit the consequences of debt because that's a good thing to do. So is God consistent? Well, yes, he is. Because when it comes to dealing not now with the debt that an Israelite citizen might have with his neighbor when their land is taken, but now we come to the debt that you and I all have with God because of our sin, what will God do about that debt? Will he be like these large financial institutions who will try to wring the very last drop out of you? Or will he behave like the God of the Jubilee? Scandal of the gospel says that God behaves like the God of the Jubilee. That God institutes things which limit the consequences of sin. For example, back in the Old Testament, at the Tower of Babel, there is that famous story of God dividing mankind and giving them different languages so it becomes very difficult to communicate. What is the reason why God does this? Because God says, when they don't have languages, look at what they do. You know? So it'd be better to split them up and then they can do far less bad things if they can't talk to each other. He seeks to limit the consequences of sin in time. And he does something he didn't want to do. He wanted the human race to be one group of people. He wanted us to be able to communicate and have fellowship together. But he divides us up. Why? So that the consequences of sin can be limited. Look at Jesus' earthly ministry. What does he do? He doesn't just teach. He heals people. Why does he do that? He limits the consequences of sin. Disease and death are the result of sin in our world. What does Jesus spend his time doing? Going around limiting the consequences. And he calls you and I to do the same, to heal people so that the consequences of evil in the world are limited and restricted. He is a consistent God. He is the God of the Jubilee. He restricts the consequences of sin. And he offers release. He offers release. He put a fixed price on my head. And he put a fixed price on your head. Here's the fixed price. Here's the deal. God pays Jesus and he gets me. What kind of a deal is that? What kind of a deal is that? He gives the perfect, sinless, spotless Son of God. He gets in return me. Full of sin, full of unworthy things, with wasted time and wasted resources and wasted all sorts of things. He pays the fixed price of Jesus. He gets me in return. Talk about depreciation. The scandal of the gospel. God is consistent. We learn that from the Jubilee. One of the reasons why it is so good to do this CAP ministry and to free people from debt. And I hear all these people being critical about this and saying, well, people aren't paying back their debts. Some people are paying back their debts in full over 4 or 5 years. All CAP is doing is interceding for them and making arrangements for them so that those things can be done. They are paying their debts. Some of them aren't. They're becoming bankrupt. But you know this is a good thing to do because what we're doing in CAP illustrates the scandal of the gospel. My sins are eternal, but I'm not going to pay eternally. Because God put a fixed price on my head that was payable, and he paid that price in Jesus, and he got me in return. And it's the same for you. The gospel is a scandal. It is the greatest markdown in human history that God gives the life of his Son that you and I might be free of the consequences of the things we have done. CAP is a vital ministry because God is concerned about economics. And when we go out of our way to try to help people get free from the oppression and burden of debt, we're doing the kinds of things that God wants us to do. But it's also an important ministry for us because it illustrates the scandal of the gospel. That I, who should pay eternally for all the wrongs in my life, have a fixed price on my head. And because God pays Jesus, he gets me in return. The largest markdown in human history. That's what the gospel is about. And it's open to every single one of you in this building this morning. Because Kathy's story could be told by everybody in church. So you may have money in the bank, all right. You might never go through some of the humiliating, embarrassing, and difficult situations that Kathy has had to cope with. That may never be your lot. But before God today, every single one of us is just like Kathy. Every single one. And the scandal of the gospel is this, that God puts a fixed price on your head, even though your debt is eternal. He pays it in Jesus, and he says, come and take it. It's the biggest markdown in human history, and you get the chance to be part of it.